Today we meet a 10-year-old cooking champion. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Catalina Frias is not your typical preteen picky eater. She likes to try a lot of different foods. It sort of runs in the family. More than eat them, though, she loves to prepare them. And she's the recent winner of the Food Network show, Chop Junior. Her sister Amelia appeared as a contestant, and we're going to talk to both of them later in the program. Edwige Dantecant has written about death in numerous works, but she tackles the issue in her newest book, not only from a personal perspective, but from the perspective of other great authors. We'll talk to her about her latest work and her advocacy for Haitians living in the U.S. under TPS. We'll start things off, though, with a brief update on the story of the Hollywood Hills nursing home where another patient has died. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We are getting a little bit of, we have a little technical difficulty, but I'm going to go ahead and just push on through. Well, yesterday, the 14th person from the Hollywood Hills nursing home died. The Hollywood Hills nursing home lost power after Hurricane Irma left more than 100 senior patients struggling in stifling hot rooms with no air conditioning. The patient who died most recently was 90-year-old Cecilia Franco. Her husband, Miguel Antonio Franco, died in the overheated center shortly after Irma hit. The nursing home laid off virtually all its workers last week and is shut down. And we're joined now by Erica Pisantis, who's been covering the story with the Sun Sentinel. Erica, are you there?
Yes.
All right. Can you hear me clearly?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. All right. Again, I'm getting a little bit of strange sound here on this side, but I'm just going to push on through. All right. Today today would have been the 100th birthday of the first victim who died from the nursing home. That was on September 13th. Albertina Vega. I hope I'm saying that right. What can you tell us about her?
So Albertina was the oldest victim. She was the first victim to perish on that September 13th, and she would have had her 100th birthday today. Family was preparing to celebrate for her 100th birthday. People were going to fly in from California. She was a retired seamstress and was very much an independent person who liked to keep her home tidy. Obviously, at that age, she had to have round-the-clock care and had to be moved into the nursing home. She had been there for about 2 years.
All right. What can you tell us about the latest death, which was Cecilia Franco? That was yesterday.
Yes, Cecilia Franco died early yesterday morning. She was 90 years old, and she had moved into the nursing home about 8 years ago after suffering a stroke. She also had Alzheimer's, and she was joined by her husband, Miguel Antonio Franco, who was 92 years old and who actually died on September 13th. He was part of that original group of seniors who passed away. They actually shared a room together at the nursing home, and they were married for 62 years.
You know, many of the victims were in their 90s, but there was one person who was, I believe, 57 years old, Dolores Biamonte.
Correct.
Who was she, and how did she pass away?
Okay, so Dolores was the youngest victim, and she actually had a rare disease that she was born with that eventually robbed her of her vision, her ability to walk, her ability to talk, and that's why she had to be in a nursing home. She had been bedridden for about 20 years. So now, the causes of death for all victims are still under investigation. They're still unknown. So that's still pending.
How did we get to the point that where people were making assumptions because they felt that, well, there was no AC in the facility? Maybe that's what the cause of death was. But why is it taking this long to figure out what's happened?
Well, investigators have to be very careful in how they link some of these deaths to the sweltering conditions of the nursing home. What medical examiners are doing as time passes is looking at patients' health records, interviewing family members to know how responsive, you know, these persons were before the power outage. Basically, if their health deteriorated and they didn't return to the state that they were in before the power outage, it's going to be a death that they're going to consider as possibly linked to this, you know, the sweltering conditions in the home.
How are the survivors doing? Because they were originally taken to a hospital nearby for treatment.
Yes, the survivors were, you know, they were all assessed on the day of the evacuation, taken to area hospitals. Most of them wound up at Memorial Regional Hospital in Hollywood, which is just next door, across the street from this nursing home. They've all since been discharged, and they've moved to other nursing homes where with beds available. So they've had to be dispersed throughout the area.
Now, you've talked to some of the relatives of those survivors, and I'm wondering what they've shared with you about, you know, what was happening at that facility before all of this happened, before the hurricane.
Yeah, actually, some of those relatives were unaware of the AC outage. They said that they had not been contacted by the nursing home itself. They themselves were dealing with, the hurricane issues at their own homes, and they trusted that the nursing home was prepared and was the safest place for their seniors. So others actually did visit after the hurricane and saw seniors in distress, some of them, overheated, having to be stripped of their clothes, placed in the cooler hallways, in wheelchairs and in beds. Some of these relatives brought their own personal fans for their loved ones and then kept them comfortable with, you know, ice water and cool towels, and even brought them outside for fresh air.
So they weren't even contacted by the facility? Nobody had called them or emailed them or anything to tell them about what had happened?
That's what I'm being told by some of those relatives. I mean, in Albertina Vega's case, the woman who would have been 100 today, her relative lives right next door to this facility and did not know. She got the call when she passed away that morning.
Now, the facility is basically shut down. I mean, the owners lost their license, but really, what happens next?
Yeah, so the state basically shut it down, as you've said, pulled its operating license. They've halted any Medicaid payments, are not allowing them to accept any more patients, and now the nursing home has sued against all of these actions, and that's still pending.
And, of course, as you mentioned, that the folks who were there, they've been taken to other facilities in the area. Is that correct?
Yes, they have been. Wherever there's beds available, I mean, in some cases there were, you know, couples who were together at Hollywood Hills Nursing Home, so it's a little tricky to find two beds together. Or for, you know, folks who had special needs, maybe a feeding tube that needed to be cared for. So that becomes a little more challenging in finding the right place for them.
And then, of course, it was reported Friday last week that they let go of all of their staff. They let go of over 250 people, but is that basically all their staff?
Yes, 245 that consisted of doctors and nurses and nursing assistants.
What surprised you most in all the reporting that you've done, and you work with a team of reporters at the Sun Sentinel on this particular story, but what has surprised you most on reporting on this story? We're a month out from the hurricane now.
There are so many players. There were so many people who were in that nursing home, and this was the end result. There was not help sought at the hospital next door within walking distance, just steps. And then you had these seniors die in quick succession. And you wonder, something could have been done sooner perhaps, and maybe lives would have been spared.
Well, again, as mentioned, we are waiting for the medical examiners to give their final reports on the causes of death for these 14 victims. And again, you know, we'll follow up on the story of what happens with this lawsuit and if the people running this nursing facility will be able to reopen in the future or what's going to happen next. We've been talking with Erica Pesantis of the Sun Sentinel, again, getting an update on the Hollywood Hills Nursing Home facility where 14 people, the 14th person died yesterday. 14 people died after they lost power. They had no air conditioning in the facility, and then all of the folks in that facility had to be moved to a nearby hospital. Erica, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, we're going to talk with author and activist Edwige Dantica. She joins us here in studio. Coming up next on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Edwige Dantica is no stranger to writing about emotionally charged topics in her stories and books, and perhaps there's no more emotionally charged issue than death. It's not new to her work, but in her latest book, The Art of Death, she approaches the idea from not only her own perspective, a personal story, the story of her mother's death, but from the perspective of numerous authors. She's also very outspoken on issues that Haitians face every day in Haiti and here in the U.S. She's been very outspoken about the plight of those Haitians depending upon TPS protections and, of course, dreamers living under DACA. Dantika was just awarded one of the Ford Foundation's prestigious Art of Change Fellowships, and she joins us now in studio. Edwige Dantika, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Writing about death is not new in your books, but this one seemed very different. It was not just because it was personal, it's the way you approached this story. You approached it from a personal story, that of your mother, but also how you intertwined other authors and the way they approach death. Why did you want to do that?
Well, my mom passed away about 3 years ago, actually around this time of year. And after that, I was really stuck about what I wanted to write next. And I felt like I didn't want to write, it was still fresh, so I didn't want to rewrite what I had just lived through. And people kept giving me books. I think that's something that a lot of people, when they're mourning, realize. You get, you know, people will give you books of poems. You'll get a lot of C.S. Lewis, like A Grief Observed, you know, like as means of comfort. And I started reading those books and then rereading books that had always turned to when writing about death or when facing my own grief. And so that's really how the whole project of the book started.
When you start working on a story based on this experience with your mother, she was diagnosed with a cancer.
Ovarian, yeah.
And when it's over, I can only imagine, I mean, you need some time to process that and, of course, go through your mourning period. But, you know, at what point do you decide, okay, I need to share this story in some way?
Well, I think as writers, we sort of have the practice. I have the practice, you know, speaking for myself, of both living an experience and seeing it from the outside in sort of a narrative way. And I think even as I was going through this process with my mother, I was narrating it to myself in some way. And so I started, when I was reading, I would take notes, and then the idea of sharing comes after, when you know what you have, when you have a shape to something. And the more I read, the more I noted it down, and really once the projects had merged, you know, this idea of talking about grief and talking about loss and also examining in this really distant way how others have done it as a way of seeking comfort. Only when all that was done did I feel like sharing. And I think with the projects of all these books, all the books we read about mourning, what their project is to make others feel like they're not alone. And so in this book, I was really trying to speak to the heart, but also in some ways to the intellect. And maybe that was a distancing mechanism, so I wasn't crying on every page.
Do you think that we just do that naturally? We try to see death intellectually so that it doesn't... death is a very difficult topic to talk to anybody about, and for some people, they don't even want to discuss it because there's a lot of fear involved. There's a lot of questions about, well, what's next, or is that the finality of everything? But do you think that it's just natural for us to want to approach it from that intellectual perspective as a safeguard?
Yeah, I think death is a very hard topic because it's all around us. You know, even as we live in this time that it seems as though, you know, even this month that we've been through with Vegas and all the hurricanes and all the devastation, and we hear about death every day, but we tend to hear about it in a global way. But when it comes into our lives, when someone very close to us dies, it always feels new. It always feels like it's just happening to us. And I think the you know, mortality itself is something that's hard to deal with. I just, you know, when you're a kid, you don't even think about mortality. And then when people at the other end, you start reviewing your life. And so it's not, I try to treat it as, it's not as much of a downer as possible, because even the dying people in my life, my father had a terminal illness and spent a long time dying, my mom less so, but they had time to reflect. And then even writers like Christopher Hitchens, who wrote as he was dying, and Audre Lorde, all those people, you know, the dying, what they tell us, you know, what I find that in my reading and my own personal experience, what they tell us most profoundly and most emphatically is to live. You know, the because people who are at the end, the regrets that they have are things that hadn't done, people they hadn't told that they loved. And so it's not as much as a downer. If you think there is an end, then you sort of really relish and cherish and really live the moments you do have.
How often do you think about your own mortality?
Well, all the time. I think if you have children, you think about it more hesitantly because you really want to see them through so many milestones and you want to be there. So I think, and also if you're writing other people's lives all the time, right? You write characters and sometimes you have to put an end to their lives. And what I've found as I've gotten older is that I do that less lightly. You know, I think about the weight of lives and sort of what we leave behind. And I feel lucky that I have this work that sort of will speak for me, even if it's only read after I'm gone by the people closest to me. But that extends one's mortality a little bit when you have something that you've created that you've left behind. And some people see that in children. Some people see that in their artwork. And some people see that in the good works that they have done.
I think about, because we're both in that stage of life where we have seen and we have lost people close to us, and so it forces you to think about your mortality maybe a little bit more, but if you do or when you do think about it, what are your feelings about death itself?
Again, as the people who...
Your death, by the way.
My own?
Yeah, thinking about your own death. That moment when you're going
to
leave.
We're really going there.
Yeah.
And one of the things I had to face in this writing of this book too is that we often imagine our death like it is on TV, and you know, that you'll have final words, and not everybody gets that, and it's something that we don't know. It could be like an instant, the unpredictability of it. And I think that's the part where I think that my mom used to say that she didn't want to long a death, and she didn't want too short. She wanted something in between, and that's exactly what she got. I mean, I would wish that I would have said everything that I wanted to say to the people I love the most, and that I would go out with them knowing that I love them and that I treasure them, and I think that would be most important to me.
Are you afraid of death?
Only because I have kids. Otherwise, I think I would be more philosophical. I would be afraid to leave behind my children. Yeah.
In this book, again, as we mentioned, is the fact that you also bring in, you know, the perspective of other writers. And I'm starting to think now maybe these were writers you were reading during mm-hmm. this mourning period. I mean, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Toni Morrison, as you mentioned, Christopher Hitchens. Who are some of the authors that you were reading, and how did you bring in their approach to their own mortality and death in how you were telling the story of your mother?
Well, there were people, good friends had given me a collection of poems by Lucille Clifton. And one of the poems it's called O Ente God. And she says, O Ente God, give to me my mother in her 30s. And it's about a daughter imagining what her mother was like when she was younger. And then the book, the C.S. Lewis, A Grief Observed, where he talks about the death of his wife from cancer, and he says to her, you know, come back to me on my deathbed. And then she says, you know, heaven will have a hard time holding me. And in the Bible, you know, my mom and I used to read the Bible together because she was also, I think, in the end trying to figure out what lay ahead. She was a very religious woman. And so all of those, you know, were on repeat for me in terms of reading. And there's something that this in the C.S. Lewis book, he talks about an element of anticipatory grief, where you're sort of anticipating your grief as you watch someone die. And there's something very profound about seeing somebody take their last breath that really encourages one to kind of, you know, live well until that moment.
How do you think that death in fiction or nonfiction, but, you know, death in fiction helps us in handling our mortality?
Well, one thing they've done study with fiction in that when we read some things, when we enter an experience, we feel as though we've lived it a little bit. I think death in fiction takes away a little bit of the of the fear of death that a lot of people have. I mean, for 100 Years of Solitude, the Marquez, for example, there's so much death in that book. But every, you know, countering every moment in that, there's also so much life. You know, these lives are very well lived. And I think in 100 Years of Solitude of that, this young woman, because in that book, it almost predates death. So there were no cemeteries when the book began. And there's a one woman who's just carrying the bones of her ancestors, of her parents with her. And I think of sort of the, you know, the metaphorical element of that. I hope we sort of all carry some element of our ancestors with us and their lives, you know, the traces of their lives that they left behind, the good example, the good works are in some ways always with us.
If they write, if your children were to write a book about you the same way you did your mother, what would you hope they get in that story? Or what do you hope that story is going to be that you're leaving for them?
Well, you know, ultimately, I think all the stories we write are our stories. You know, my mother had an extraordinary life. She was an immigrant from Haiti. She was undocumented when she came to New York and left two children behind, me and my brother, and then we were separated for 8 years. I mean, it was a very heartbreaking in some moments life. But at the end, we came together, and both my parents, as they were dying, you know, when my father was dying about 10 years ago, my brother asked him, did you enjoy your life? And he said, you know, I didn't have vacations, I didn't make tons of money, but I had you guys. And that was the whole project of our immigration, of everything. And I know my mom felt the same way, because she left us a cassette with her, among instructions to, you know, with between what to wear to the funeral and all that, you know. She said she was glad that she had made this journey, everything in her life, because of how we came out. I think I would want my children to realize that there were a lot of bumps on the road, you know, a lot of obstacles, but that so much had been sacrificed for a better life.
I'm speaking with author and activist Edwige Dantica and talking about her latest work, The Art of Death, a fascinating story. Again, sharing a very personal story about her own mother's death, but bringing in this eclectic mix of authors and how they've approached the topic of death. You're listening to Sundial here on WLRN. I wanted to, because, you know, as I mentioned, you're also an activist. You're very outspoken about immigration issues, but specifically we're talking about immigrant children, those protected by DACA, but also the plight of Haitians, those in Haiti, here in the United States as well. Now, the latest news is that representatives from Haiti have reached out to the White House, have reached out to this administration, asking for the extension of TPS. And again, this is the protection for almost 60,000 Haitians living in the United States right now, those who have suffered through not only the earthquake, but, you know, hurricanes and so many other things. The administration has said that they are going to end TPS early next year, and this leaves a lot of people in limbo. Right now, what is it that you're trying to do to convince this particular administration to extend this, and what exactly is it you're asking of them?
Well, I mean, I think we're very, a lot of families in our communities are very fearful, because TPS comes up every 2 years, temporary protected status. And as you said, about 60,000 Haitians are sort of waiting to hear, and they'll need to know by November, if there'll be an extension. And even in the gap, in the uncertainty, it was the 6 months that was granted to January. A lot of people have already lost their jobs, and we've had even some panic in that recently you had hundreds of people who have tried to go to Canada because they're not sure what their destiny will be here. I think as I heard recently, a young activist in our community, a young woman named Christina, who spoke at the an Arcade Fire concert to explain the plight, as she was saying, you know, the extension is important, but we also need to have more permanent solutions, both to TPS and DACA, because we don't want to be 2 years from now having this very same conversation. What the government of Haiti has written this letter that the ambassador sent to the U.S. Government, to the Homeland Security head recently, is that they're saying they're not ready to accept all these people. And so it makes sense that for them to have at least another 2 years to extend the status and to see what happens next as we move towards a more permanent solution.
And you talk about the Haitians who have now tried to make their way up to Canada. And we talked about that actually here on WLRN with a reporter who was up at the border and was watching as these Haitians were basically just walking across and then getting arrested. But very interesting story, strange story, in that they almost received better treatment when they were under arrest in Canada than they did here in the United States. Again, talking with author and activist Edwige Danteca, talking about her latest book, The Art of Death, but also talking about Haitian TPS, an issue that's been very important here in South Florida. We're going to take a quick break and continue this conversation here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio with author and activist Edwige Danteca about her latest work, again, The Art of Death. But we've been talking about Haitian TPS, and that's it's been a big story here in South Florida. And Edwige, we talked about, you're talking about tens of thousands of Haitians living, especially here in Florida right now. I wanted to talk about the fact that that TPS protection could end in January if the administration does not extend it again. That could mean the deportation of all of these people. Are there people, have you talked to people who are just preparing, they've convinced themselves, maybe I just have to leave now?
Well, I think a lot of people, especially people with children, have a very difficult choice to make. And immigrant families are often mixed status families. So you'll have U.S.-born children, you have undocumented, you have some documented, and many families who have TPS find themselves in this situation. There are people who also have businesses, who really have deep ties in the community. So I think it's a very tough dilemma for people, but the problem is that they're very easily found because they registered for this program, and if they're here and if the government wants to deport them, they know how to find them. So it's a very sad and difficult situation for many families who will be separated. Many children, I would imagine, will either return with their families, or some might be in foster care and different situations. But ultimately, people, I've been at conferences at discussions where people have been asked to make contingency plans for their children, for their property, and to really make very impossible and difficult choices about their future.
There are some in the administration, some in this country, who believe that Haiti can take them back now, that Haiti, everything is getting better in Haiti. But what can you tell people about what's really happening right now in the country of Haiti?
Well, I was just in Haiti last week, and most of that week, there were a series of demonstrations because the government has set forth this budget that a lot of people are objecting to. The United Nations forces, which was really an occupying force this past 13 years, is pulling out, leaving behind a catastrophic situation with cholera. Close to a million people have been affected by the cholera that was brought in by the Nepalese peacekeepers. The country is really still recovering from last year from Hurricane Matthew in the south. And so there are a lot of the similar issues that prompted the temporary prosthetic status in the first place. And if you have a government, the heads of the country are asking that the people not be returned. There's obviously not going to be a red carpet for those who are being deported.
And again, the Haitian government asking the U.S. to extend that TPS. I can't let you go without asking you also about the fact that there are Haitians living in the Dominican Republic, which has expelled thousands of people of Haitian descent. What are the latest developments in that situation?
Well, I think the way that the people who have been returned from the Dominican Republic have been treated can be a model of what can possibly happen with people who are being deported here. Some of the people who are being deported here might have a bit more means, but what happened on the border of the Dominican Republic, aside from some social organizations and maybe some efforts minimally from the government, there are people who are living in squalor right on the border with their children and families, people who didn't know who were, as a result of the constitutional decision in the Dominican Republic, lost their papers, lost their nationality, some of them, who had never been to Haiti, who didn't know anybody in Haiti. So they were stranded in this sort of no man's land on the border that was in really, really sad conditions with very little support from the government.
And you and fellow novelist Juno Diaz, who's from a Dominican family, have been speaking together on the situation. What's that partnership been like?
Well, it's been really wonderful because I feel like the friendships that I have had with Juno Diaz, Julia Alvarez, and other Dominican activists, and their support for, actually, because this issue doesn't just affect Haitians, Dominicans of Haitian descent, Black Dominicans, and migration, as we're seeing, is a worldwide issue right now. You know, we see what's happening in Europe with millions of people coming through. So it's not unique to us. And people have been migrating for better opportunities from the beginning of time. And it just seems like now there's a right wing rising and all these different issues. So I think these partnerships, these allyships, if you will, understand that. And we have to, especially in this time of such anti-immigration scapegoating, we have to stand up for each other. TPS, DACA, you know, whether you've been here a while, whether you just got here, we all have to stand up for each other because these are very precarious and perilous times.
Edwige Dantecott is the author of her latest work is The Art of Death. And again, as we've been talking about, she's an activist. So we've been talking about Haitian TPS and some of the challenges that tens of thousands of Haitians living here in the United States in Florida, in South Florida, are dealing with as they await any word from the U.S. government on what their status is going to be. Edwige, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, coming up next, we're going to meet a pair of sisters who recently competed on the Food Network's Chopped Junior. One of them won. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, recently, the Frias family got together to watch a special episode of the Food Network's Chopped Junior. Why that show? Well, because their youngest, 10-year-old Catalina Frias, was announced the winner. Her older sister, Amelia, had also been a contestant on the program. And we sat down with the two cooking wizards and their parents, their mother, Christine Martinez de Castro, and their father, Carlos Frias, yes, the food and dining editor of the Miami Herald. We started with how Catalina learned about the opportunity to even try out for the show.
It was when I did a baking class, and at the end they gave us a packet, and it said join for like the baking kids show, but then my mom was like, yeah, you're not good at baking. So we did the Chopped Junior one. We signed up, and to be honest, I have terrible luck, but now I do have good luck. But we just signed up, not like just saying like, nah, just do it. We don't even know if we're gonna make it or not, because there's like thousands of kids there.
All right. Mom, Dad, I mean, come on. They come at you and they want to be on a television show?
I really, honestly, as a parent, and as most parents know, I really did it to kind of shut them up because she kept begging me to put on their show. And I was like, okay, I'll do the application, but never in a million years did I think they would actually call. So I promised her and I filled it out. She saw it. She asked me and I'd fill it out. But realistically,
Amelia saw me.
She's like, Mom, what are you doing? She's like, I want to do it too. My oldest said, now just eat. Not interested in cooking. That's fine. So, I mean, but realistically, thousands of children try out for these shows. So I didn't, you know, really think and they called it within 24 hours.
Within 24 hours?
Within 24 hours. I mean, it was a long process from there on, but actually the first phone call came, and I almost did not pick up the phone because I didn't recognize it. I really never in a million years thought they would ever call.
Carlos, what was that like for you? Was it an easy decision?
It was one of those things where you don't think they're going to get picked, right? No. So you just, yeah, go ahead and fill out the paperwork. I mean, I'll be honest. Knowing all the stories we hear about kids that are on TV that then go on to be on child actors and everything else, like I was a little skeptical, you know. And even as they started practicing, you know, they're kind of practicing for the show, like in case they got picked. I never wanted it to be like homework for them, you know, and I was worried, I didn't want to give them too much, you know, if it was going to feel like homework. But they never had those fears. They just enjoyed it. They asked for it. They asked to do it, to cook, to be challenged. Dad, let's do Chop tonight.
Practice. What does that mean? What's practice like?
Well, you don't know if you're going to make it on the show. They start contacting you, but you really don't know till last minute. And it could take months. It could take, you know, a long time. But in the meantime, they tell you to start preparing. So the way that we prepared is we would just the way the show works is you get four ingredients and you have to make a meal.
And they put it in a basket.
So what we would do is we would find ingredients that kind of didn't mesh well together. And I would do everything from leftovers. I mean, I would try to clear out the refrigerator to every now and then I would find some weird ingredient like canned jackfruit or something. And I would just throw something in there. And then knowing that it may come out absolutely horrible, what we did was we stuck to like appetizer sized portions. Their sister loved judging them. She would play judge and critiquing, which was a family affair. So it was fun.
In the show, they give you this basket and they give you a number of ingredients. Mm-hmm. And then you have to just make something out of it. So when you're practicing, I mean, your mom just told me some of the stuff that they put in there. What was it like when you were practicing?
Well, some of the stuff were really weird. Some of them were really familiar.
What's the weird one?
What was it? It was like
matcha.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Matcha powder.
Matcha and matcha powder. That was really weird. Then we made cookies and cakes.
You had edamame. We gave you the edamame pasta.
That's what it was, edamame pasta.
We had microwavable roast beef.
I gave him beer once. I said, you got to cook with beer to deglaze the pan, you know, and everything else. So I gave him that and pineapple. And so she had to learn, like, you know, those are little skills that we figured, you know, would help in the show is, like, learning how to cut a pineapple.
So one of their favorite desserts to this day came from a Chop basket. They had the matcha green tea, like fresh matcha green tea, leftover cheesecake, cashew nuts, and marshmallows. And one of them made a matcha green tea cake with a cream cheese frosting with marshmallows in it and crushed cashews. And Amelia made, you made the cookie, right? Catalina made the green tea matcha cookie.
With cashews and with the cashews inside. And then I used the cheesecake and the marshmallows and I made a sauce.
Like a glaze.
Cookies.
And to this day, it's their favorite dessert. And it came from that concoction, which was just...
I love the cookie and I don't like cheesecake.
Amelia, what was it like competing with your sister?
It was a lot of fun because it wasn't really... I was competitive, but it wasn't that big of a deal because I always compete against her. But it was a lot of fun, mainly.
Well, how competitive are you guys with each other?
We're really competitive.
Very.
But like what? Tell me, give me an example when you are really competitive with her.
Well, we play volleyball. We're really competitive towards each other because we always want to win. And in school, we try to get good grades. We try to beat each other.
All right, so when you're on this television show, though, and you're competing with her, what's that like?
You wanna like, be there with your sibling and comfort them, but you also want to rip them to shreds and take the money.
Amelia, you were ousted in one of the rounds, correct?
Yeah.
Tell me what was going on that day, in that particular round. What was in your basket?
We had fresh pasta, peas in a pod, candied jalapenos, and pancetta.
And what'd you do with it?
Well, I tried to make a pasta patty with pancetta in it, but the patty fell apart, so I just made pasta. And I made a salad with peas and tomatoes and the sauce from the candied jalapenos.
What's it like when the judges are... I guess at that point, looking at you and looking at what you've done, and then they got to just tell you, nope, that's not what, you know, it's not enough.
It's kind of scary, but it's okay because it was really hard to get there, and even being there was enough.
And then you're watching your sister. What happened then?
Well, I was rooting for her. Like, I was watching her and I was rooting for her, but
one part when I was making the ice cream, I forgot to strain the eggs, so she told me that she was screaming at the TV, saying, "Strain the eggs!"
What happened when you saw your sister, Amelia, being ousted from the show?
Well, they didn't show this on the TV, but she started going, and I tried to keep my tears in until we got to the cookie jar, which is the place where the kids go after they judge. And I was crying, and then they started, like, to comfort me. But I cried. Because, it's normal in the show, like, that you see the kids, because they're not there. They know that their sibling wasn't there from the start. But then you knew that your sibling was there, and knowing that she was gone and, like, you don't have someone to at least help you, it's kind of nerve-wracking.
Amelia, what's it like watching yourself on TV? What's it like watching your sister on TV, too?
Well, it was okay because I had already seen Gata in the dessert round, so I already knew what was going to happen there. But in the entree round, I had no idea, like, how she prepared her food at all because I was being interviewed during that time. But it was really cool because I don't know how she survived without me, and that she did, and then she still won. It was crazy.
It's because she thinks that she's my mother, but I already have
one. They have an interesting dynamic. And one of the things that Gata pointed out, which is true, because I saw the raw footage, Gata had a hard time when she was cut because she feels very supported. They've been sharing a room since they were tiny. So she feels very supported, and Amelia very much takes on the role of being her big sister and mothers her quite a bit.
For sure.
So she's very comfortable and taking the back seat and sort of supporting her baby sister, and we're very proud of her for that. She does a very good job of that and is always there for Catalina.
Why is it that all of you are so obsessed with food? I can understand Carlos, it's his job, but why is everybody so obsessed with food?
Well, because the food makes my little taste buds go happy.
That's a good one. Carlos, where does this come from?
I think it just comes from, when I was a kid, I grew up, my parents worked all the time. They worked full time. They had a little jewelry store. And even at the store, they always cooked. They had a little stove in the back of the store, separated the front and the back. And my mom and dad would cook. And so we would eat together every day, even no matter what the setting was. So I think you know, food for us, it was always important to sit and have a meal together and to sit at the table, like to sit at the family table. Having a meal together. I think they just got used to seeing that.
But aren't kids picky eaters?
Well, Not these.
They have a food blog, and one of the reasons it started, I come from a very diverse background, so I grew up, even though my parents were Cuban, probably the least food I ate was Cuban. We ate a lot of Mediterranean, Chinese, real Chinese, and things of that nature. So they grew up going to dim sum from a very, very young age, just trying different food, and we always had a rule that they had to try something once, and we would never make them try to eat it again, but as a courtesy, they had to try it once.
All right, I want to hear from both of you. Amelia, real quick, what's something that you had to try you really never want to try again?
Raisins.
You don't like raisins?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I just don't like raisins.
Is it something about the texture or the flavor?
It's kind of both.
Both? All right, raisins. Catalina, what don't you ever want to try again?
Two things. One is sushi, unless it's a sushi that you get to make that has steak in it. And also poke bowls.
All right, so two things. By the way, because you were talking about the blog, it's a Tumblr account, right? It's Three Little Forks.
No, they actually have their own domain.
They have their own domain.
ThreeLittleForks.com.
The Three Little Forks. Tell me where that came from. Where did that idea come from and how you all involved in it?
Well, it started, Carlos came up with the name. It started because we would go to eat dim sum every Sunday, and they knew exactly what they wanted to eat. And they, you know, we were talking about how children should try some of these things. They might like it as well. They would beg me every Sunday to go eat dim sum. So it started out as just a way from a child's perspective to talk about how delicious these foods were and try to get other kids to try them. And that's sort of how it's continued. Now they have some recipes that they've put in there, and they cook a few different things as well. But it's really, really just about their love of food. And they really do love to eat. And if you don't let them try something and you sit here and you eat it, they'll hover over you until they can. They may not like it, but they want to try it. Yeah.
I think one of the smartest things we did growing up, when they were growing up, even 2 and 3 years old, we would put a salad on their plate whether they ate it or not. Like, there was always a green on the plate. And sometimes they would go untouched for a while, but you get, the kid gets over seeing it there, and eventually out of curiosity you'll have it. And they will lean towards vegetables. You know, if you let them, like, they'll eat Brussels sprouts, they have to be prepared in a very specific way for me to have them. But in general, like, the smell of Brussels sprouts baking in the house will, like, send me out, you know, for the rest of the day. But they will pop them like popcorn. So, I mean, you know, it's who knew?
Amelia and Catalina, how much time do you spend on this website, on the Three Little Forks? What kind of things you'd like to talk about?
Well, we talk about some food that we make, restaurants that we go to. My favorite restaurant that we've probably blogged about for dinner is El Mago de las Fritas. They're technically Cuban hamburgers. And the best dessert place is probably Vicky's House. Oh, their milkshakes are so good.
Amelia, what about you?
I like this one place that we went to in Universal called Cowfish. And they had this thing called Burgushi, which is a mix of burgers and sushi. And I think that was my favorite.
Mom, Dad, what do you think about the fact that, you know, they're going to be recognized?
You know, really, I haven't thought that much about it. Honestly, I can only speak for myself. What I've thought about it, and I don't even want to get emotional thinking about it, is that this is such a great memory for them that they're going to take forever. It gets sad. I mean, yeah, that they get to experience as sisters, because it's one thing that you do it by yourself, but, you know, they're going to grow up and they're going to talk to their kids about this moment. I've never thought about it from a star's perspective, but I think it's such a beautiful thing that, like, is going to pull them together and that they're always going to be able to reference. And even though I was there, they didn't let me get near them and I was in a separate room. So they really, really, really had to depend on each other. And it's something that they share exclusively.
When they were on the set?
Everything that had to do with it, they separated the parents, which terrified me, because as a parent, you want to help them, you know? And they really, really, really had to support each other and be there for each other. This is their memory. All of it. You know, the preview party, their friends supporting them. This is their memory together for the rest of their lives.
Mommy, you're making me cry. Stop.
Yeah, look at this. What?
Sorry.
Carlos, all right, as well, they cleared themselves up. I mean, for you, what are some of the memories that you take with you after this?
I'm just glad that they had a good experience. You know, obviously my worry was always that, I don't know, I had those child actors on TV, you know, worries. But the truth is, it was so great to see them really support each other. And something that could have really fed into the sibling rivalry, right? I mean, you have a brother, how competitive you can be, and it could have really fed into that. And instead, it brought out something really, really sisterly in them. I was really pleased at that. That's one of the things that I think I'll remember even years later.
Who's the best cook
me.
In the house?
Oh, no, it's definitely me, because I won.
All right, Catalina, outside of the competition, though, really, in this room, with all of you, who's really the best cook? Come on.
Oh, out of this room?
In this room.
As in parents, too?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it depends, because Ami's really good at Cuban. Dad's also really good at Cuban, but they do different ways to do it. And Mom's really good at just comfort food.
That is really a fun story, talking with the Frias family. And again, congratulations to Catalina Frias for winning Chopped Junior on the Food Network. Her sister Amelia was also on the program as a contestant as well. Also want to thank Christine Martinez de Castro, their mother, and Carlos Frias, their father. He is, of course, the food and dining editor for the Miami Herald. Really an amazing story that these preteens are so great in the kitchen, which says a lot about me, in that at this stage of my life, I think I can cook a TV dinner. That's all for Sundial on Tuesday, October 10th. Sundial is produced by Maeve McGoran and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Mertz. And our technical supervisor, Jason Zapka. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Go to gopalo.com. That's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you again on Thursday.